Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kuf Samach Gimel and Mabed, two lines from the bottom. Kuf, we're going back to the statement that we saw on yesterday's daf, Amarav, Shtar Habahu Ve'edav Al Machak Kasher. If you have a shtar by which the shtar itself is written on erased kalaf, as well as the fact that the edim are on erased kalaf, that is fine, that is kasher. Vim Tomar Mochek Vechuzer Mochek. If you say what happened here is that he's going to erase and then go back and erase again, it's a question of whether really the first mochek is necessary over here, because it seems that we're speaking about a shtar that was already erased. The shtar itself, or the cloth itself, has already been erased, and now it's written, the shtar and the edim are signed on this erased document, or this erased cloth, and then he's going to have them sign on it, and then he'll erase the shtar on the top and write whatever he wants. Because now the shtar is written on an area that was erased, and so are the edim signed on an area that's erased. The Gemara says, "Enu debe nimchak pamachat, le nimchak shtei pe'amim." You can't compare something that's erased once to something that is erased twice. First of all, cloth, in terms of the thickness of the cloth, when you erase, in those days, you took off a layer of the cloth. So if you erase twice versus erase once, the depth of the cloth, or the thickness of the cloth, will give an indication of the number of times it was erased. That's one way to view it. And in that way of viewing it, you would be able to tell simply by the erasure that there's a difference between this part of the document and that part of the document. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot here spend time on discussing this, and he makes the point to say, venerely, Dehainu shekutev ala machak, that the only time that you notice this is when you rewrite on the erased areas. As nikar ezu nimchak pamachat veezu nimchak shtei pe'amim. Then you can see the difference between what was erased once and was erased twice. Aval haniyar machuk greida. If you're just looking at a cloth that's been erased, shein katuv alav klum, if nothing written on it, oto enu nikar. That is not as obvious. So the Balei Tosafot say that simple erasure, or looking at a blank cloth, is hard to tell if it was erased once, twice, parts of it once, parts of it twice. When you write on it, then it becomes noticeable or visible, the difference between them. Probably has to do with the absorption of the ink into the cloth. And for that reason, you'll get a different effect when you write on one part of it than the other part, but then it'll be obvious. You'll be able to see it from the fact that it's written on these two different areas. So the Balei Tosafot say that it's really focused on the writing there rather than the erasure itself. One of the main proofs of Tosafot is that the next Gemara has the edim signing on a document that was erased twice, and the document was on an area that was erased once. And it seems like the edim are not discerning, or they're unable to see the fact that they are writing on an area that was erased twice. And so therefore they suggest that you can't tell by simply looking at the cloth. It's only once you've written on it can you make that discernment or that determination as the fact that there's a difference in the erasure here than the erasure in the other part of the document. And then he says, maybe I'm going to take that back a little bit, because there is a possibility we could differentiate between lay people and Beit Din. Lay people who don't see documents all the time, who don't see cloth all the time, maybe they can't discern between a document that was erased once or twice, unless it's written on, then it'll become obvious. But Beit Din, they might have the possibility of noticing or catching the erasure once or twice, even without having it being written on. Because they see documents all the time. They see cloth all the time. It's like a sofer. Sofer who spends a lot of time with cloth will have a better feel for erasure and seeing whether the cloth was erased once or twice, irrespective of if you write on it or not. Whereas for lay people, that's a little harder. Velechosh, the Gemara says, Dilma shadi diyuta makom edim meikara. What he'll do is he'll throw or spill ink on the area where the edim signed, umachikle, and erase it. Dechi other machikle lahai, habili idi v'idi nimchak shtei pe'amim. Then when he goes and erases the upper part, it'll be nimchak shtei pe'amim. So what he'll do is he'll throw ink on the area where the edim are going to sign. He'll erase it. They will have two erasures in both places. Because what he did up front was that he erased the area where the edim signed by throwing ink on that area. Then he throws ink on the whole document and erases the whole document. That means that the upper part of the cloth has been erased once. The area where the edim signed has been erased twice. So now the edim will sign on the area where it's erased twice. He had the shtar on the area that was erased once. He'll erase the shtar, now write something, and now they'll be of equal erasure, meaning that he'll be writing on two areas that have been erased twice. So now you have a possibility, you have a forgery where the original document was written on two different types of erasures. So where it says, Amar Abayi Kasavarav, Ene Edim Chutmim Ala Machak, Ilim Ken Nimchak Bifnehem. Edim don't sign on an erased area unless the erasure was done before them. So that here you have an indication or a way to discern what was happening with the document. If he comes with the blank cloth that's been erased in front of them, they won't sign on it. Maybe because they can't discern the difference between what they're signing on and what is the shtar has been written on. But more importantly, we want them to see what was there beforehand. And then they will get a sense or an understanding of what happened beforehand. Because if he comes now to erase it, they'll see that he's erasing something that was never erased before versus something that was already erased once. And in that way, they'll know that the area where they're signing is different than the remainder of the cloth. And through that, they will be able to discern or know that there's something wrong over here, or there's a difference between the erasure that's done in the area they're signing versus the erasure that was done on the upper part of the document. Right now, we were speaking about a document that was erased. And we said, if you write on a document that was erased and sign on it, it's fine. Gemara says, why should that be fine? The guy can play around with the document. So at first, we said, that's not an issue, because if you erase twice, it'll be noticeable versus being erased once. So then the Gemara says, okay, let's assume that he erased the document once, but he erased the area where the Edim are signed twice, and now he's having them sign in that area, he'll erase the top, and then the shtar and the Edim will have the similar type of document that they're written on, and you have a problem. The Gemara says, Edim can't sign unless they can see what was erased. They can watch the erasure, or they have a sense of what was being erased over here. Meitavei. So Gemara says, now we have a new scenario. The document is written on new cloth. The Edim are signed in an area that was erased. Fine. So here you have, again, a similar situation, but from the outset, it just starts at one step beforehand, which is that he signed on area that was erased, but the document was written on new cloth. Obviously, that opens up the same problem, which is that after they've signed on the erased area and he wrote a new cloth, you erase the new cloth, and then you're back to a case where the Edim and the Shtar are written on the same level of erasure. It's a first level erasure. Why aren't we worried about the fact that he erased the top, the Shtar, and write whatever he wants? And then the Shtar and the Edim will be on the same level of erasure, one first time erasure, and it would be a fine document. Because they write over here, Nachnu Sade, that they write into the document that we, the Edim, are signed on a document in which the document itself was written on new cloth, and our signatures were on an area that was erased. That solves the problem, because now they're declaring the nature of the document versus where they signed. There's a difference here, and they're going to sign to that effect. Now, Gemara says, depends where they write that. If they're going to write this on the document, it could be subject to the same problems that you have with the document itself. Even the tachat, if it's below their signatures, gaizle, he'll just slice it off, and then you won't have that disclaimer anymore. E'ilai, if it's above their signatures, machikle, he'll erase it with the rest of the shtar. You said the shtar is written on the niyar, and then they are signed on an area that is machuk. So if they write it above their signatures, that's going to be on the niyar. So when he erases the shtar, he'll erase this line as well, or this disclaimer as well, and you'll be in the same boat, which is you have no idea that there was a disclaimer here, because now everything looks uniform, where everything looks like it was erased once. Tichtive, pensado, desado. They write it in between the edim. They leave a gap between the edim, and in that gap between the edim, they sign, or they put this disclaimer that says that we signed on an area that was machuk, and the document was written in an area that was niyar. Now once again here, you could have a possibility that someone will come in and erase that which is found between the two signatures. Because if you erase that which is between the two signatures, the signatures are still intact, and you'll just erase the disclaimer that sits between them. So here you have to take one of two approaches. One approach is to suggest that it would be noticeable. If it was on an erased area already, then if you erase between them, it'll look like you erased it twice versus once. That's according to those that say that you can notice without writing the difference between we erased once and erased twice. Because here they signed an area that was erased, and then this disclaimer was between them. The guy goes and erases the disclaimer. So the area where the disclaimer now has been erased twice. So if up front you're able to tell that, that's what the Baal Tosfot rejected, that it's not possible to tell that. If you could discern that, then you would know right away that he erased it. The other way to deal with it is what the Baal Tosfot do. The Baal Tosfot say it's not discernible when you haven't written on it between one erasure and two erasures. So then what do you do here? He says that any shtar that is machuk, that has edim that have gap between them, will automatically be pasul. That edim have to sign close together. If they don't sign close together, then the gap between them will automatically make the shtar pasul, just because there's a gap between the edim. Why? Because we're choshesh for exactly this problem. That there was some information between the two edim that got erased. And so therefore we will not be machshir any document that has gapping between the two edim. And that's what the Baal Tosfot say over here. The Tav Yishlamar, Dolo Machshirin Huve Davla Machak. We will not be machshir a document where the edim and the document are on a machak. Elot She'in Revach Ben Eid Be'eid. Unless there is no space between the edim, Kedei Lichtov Anach Nasadei. The amount of space that you could have written this disclaimer there. V'rivam Perush Tein Lachush Shemi Machak Anach Nasadei. Rivam says you don't have to worry about that erasure. Came into Mikara Katav Al Machak, because it was originally written on something that was erased. V'michakenu Avlei Nimchak Bet Pa'amin. Then if you erase it, it'll be double erased, and you'll notice the difference. And that goes back to what the Tosfot said before. They reject that and say you can't tell that. You can only tell that after you've written on it, but just the erasure itself you won't tell. So they reject the Rivam's view. But here you see there are two ways to deal with the problem. Once you have that disclaimer written between the edim, one way is to say it'll be noticeable if you erase it because it's a duplicate erasure. That's the Rivam's view. The Baal Tosfot would say that's not discernible. Only when you write on it will it be discernible, and here you won't know that. So it'll be discernible because anytime you leave a gap between edim, pasul. If you find that the edim are signed on machak and there's a gap between them, the shtar is automatically pasul, because then we are choshesh that there was something written between them that he erased. And so if you want it to be kasher and it's machuk and it's erased, you'll have to have the edim signed close together, because that'll be an indication that the shtar and the area where they signed was machuk up front. But if there's a gap between them, and now we see the shtar is an area that's machuk, that already is suspicious that the original document was on klap, that was not erased, and they signed on the machak, and they put the disclaimer there. He erased the disclaimer, and then erased the whole top, and rewrote the shtar. So that's why we will not allow a shtar that has gapping between it to be kasher. So that's how the Baal Tosfot deal with it. To just know that the Rashba, and the Shutta Rashba, he deals with a different issue, which is, if you have a disclaimer between the two edim, how many edim signed on that disclaimer? Because the disclaimer is after the first aid, before the second aid. That means that the second aid signs on it, he's really signing on the disclaimer, but the disclaimer is after the first aid signed, so maybe he's not signed on the disclaimer. Maybe you don't have two edim here on the disclaimer. So he deals with that issue, saying that Eid Echad is Ne'aman in general, and over here we're going to believe that when he put the disclaimer in, he was speaking on behalf of both Edim and not just on behalf of himself, otherwise he wouldn't have written it in there. But it is an issue when you write between the two Edim, which is a protective mechanism over here to stop people from forging, but it might create a separate issue, which is now the disclaimer is only signed on by one of the two Edim because it came after one of the Edim. Just be aware that that's another area of halacha where the Rishonim are trying to deal with how exactly this works or how does the disclaimer work. From the Gemara, it seems like they sign horizontally and the gapping is between the horizontal signing, and then we spoke about yesterday that that situation, you'd have to be right justified. There can't be anything on the right side. Those of us played around whether if there's margin there, so maybe it's okay, or maybe there's even if there's margin there, it's problematic, because then someone could insert a one-line shtar in front of them. Or you could just say that they're one above the other, and in the gap between them, they put this disclaimer. Either way, you get the same impact or effect over here. All right, so now the Gemara says, okay, now that you've come up with this solution, what are you going to do with the latter half? Hu alamachak, if the document, the shtar, is written on the erased area of the klaf, ve'edav alaniyar, and the edim are signed on klaf that has never been erased. Pasul. There it is, pasul. Amai pasul. What are you worried about over here? Hachanami nichtevu hachi. Why don't they just put a disclaimer in there? Anachna sade, chatamnu al niyara. We, the edim, signed on area that was not erased, fresh klef. Ushtara machaka. And the shtar was written on an area that was erased before. Hashtanami, maya mart. What are you going to say over here? Mucheik v'chozer u'mucheik. That what is he going to do? He's going to erase it again. The whole fear is that he's going to erase the shtar again because their writing or their disclaimer says we signed on fresh klaf, but the document was written on erased area. So now once they say that, your fear now is what is he going to do? He's going to go erase the top again and write. Amart inu domen nimchak pamachat linimchak shtei pe'amim. Didn't you already say, isn't it obvious that when you erase once, it's different than when you erase twice? And again here, the Balei Tosafot say it's not about the erasure, it's when you write the second shtar, it'll be obvious that it was written on an area that was erased twice versus the area that was erased once. It says, that's when the Edim are signed on an area that's erased. The contrast between the two makes it obvious. Where the Edim are not signed on the area that's erased, Ela Aniyoro on Klaf, Lo Yedia. It is not as obvious. And what you have over here is that the discernment of between a single erasure and a duplicate erasure is only obvious when it's contrasted with another erased area. So if it's erased once, it's erased twice, you'll either see by the absorption of the ink, the color of the ink, the way that it sits, or the clearness of the writing, you'll be able to tell the difference between an area that was erased once and an area that was erased twice. So in that manner, before we also were suspect when the Edim signed in an area that was erased and the shtar was in an area that was erased, we said that that would be problematic because then he'll come and erase the shtar again. But there you had contrasting pieces of parchment, which is the upper part of the parchment and the lower part of the parchment were different. And that's how you noticed her. That's how you could tell. On the other hand, over here, there's no contrasting. Because you have the upper part of the shtar, which is machuk, and the lower part of the area, which was on kalaf. And now when he goes afterwards and erases the shtar again and writes on it, you have nothing to contrast that against to see this was erased twice versus once. And it won't be discernible. So now you have a problem. If they put the disclaimer at the bottom, which says we sign on kalaf, fresh kalaf, and it's still, they're still on fresh kalaf, and the document was written on an erased area, and the document is still erased on an erased area, just not clear. Now it's erased twice versus erased once. That you will not be able to tell. So Gemara says, "Veleite migilta achrite, velimchok, velidame." So let's just do an easy test. You'll bring another piece of cloth. You'll erase that cloth and write on it, and you'll be able to see whether they are of a similar ilk or not. Lo dami machaka da hamigilta, lo machaka da hamigilta. You can't use two different pieces of cloth. Every cloth is different, both from the thickness, so therefore the erasures look different, as well as its absorptive capabilities will be different. And in that way, you'll get a different outcome, even though you're doing the exact same thing to both documents. So Gemara says, "Ulekablo lechatimat yodo desade bebeitina velimchok velidame." So what we'll do is the Beit Din will look at the Edim signature. They will validate or verify the Edim signature. Then we will erase the area where the Edim are. The area where the Edim are is klaf right now. It's fresh klaf. The shtar is written on an erased area. So what they'll do is they'll accept the edut. They'll basically, in a sense, what we would do today is you photocopy it so that you have evidence that it was signed. Then you erase the signatures and see when you write on that area or when you look at that area, is it similar to the shtar above? So Rav Hoshaya, eno donen nimchak ben yomo, le nimchak ben shnei yamim. It's different between a fresh erasure versus an older erasure. Here, the document up top was already erased a while ago. This erasure you're doing is fresh right now. And that have a different impact in terms of the ink or the way that it looks. So Gemara says, Vilishaye, just let it wait. Let it sit. Let it ferment. So that we will see what it looks like after time. Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, Chashinan the Beit Din Toin. We're worried about a Beit Din who will make a mistake. Over here, the Rashbam already introduces the problem that there were many different girsa'ot. Our Gemara has a girsa by which it gives both answers. But the Gemara, you can see here by the Rashbam, says eat Sfarim, Digarsin and Behov and Ishayel. There were some Sfarim that have the girs in it that we should let it wait around. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, Choshishin the Beit Din Toin. And then you have Rabbi Yirmiyah's answer. Hilkach, Paskua the Milte, Upaslu Koshtar. Therefore, they made it into a standard din, which is that all shtarot in this manner will be problematic. Anything that is the shtar la machak, veidava l'niyar. The shtar is in an erased area, and the edim are signed on fresh cloth. Ve'italo garse v'nishaye. There's some people that don't have the girsa of v'nishaye. V'garse, and the simply the answer is, Rabbi Yirmiyah Omer, chashin on the beit din toin. We just worry about a beit din toin. Ubimakom teirutz raboshaya, teirutz Rabbi Yirmiyah kach. So instead of the answer of Rabbi Shaya now, they have the answer of Rabbi Yirmiyah. So that's the difference in the Gemaras, which is they'll either take out Rabbi Shaya completely and say that instead of Rabbi Shaya's answer, which is Eino Dominim Chak Ben Yomol and Nim Chak Ben Shnei Yamim, they'll just simply say the answer was Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah Chashin the Beit Din Toin. Look at the Balei Tosafot. Mandalo Garisle, the one who leaves that Girsa out, Savar Kamoke Eino Dominim Nim Chak Ben Shnei Yamim Nim Chak Ben Shlosha. That the one who leaves it out believes that the Shia doesn't do anything for you. Because up front, there's a difference between something that was erased today versus something that was erased yesterday. In 3 days from now, it'll be the same problem, which is you're just pushing it along. The erase, something that was erased 4 days ago is different than something that was erased 3 days ago. And so that problem persists, and you can never have a solution to the problem. So those people that leave out the Girsa, according to the Baya Tosafot, is because that's not a valid answer. For the Shia. So here are three different ways to read the Gemara. One way to read the Gemara is, Amar Rabbi Yoshaya, Inu Domen Nimchak Ben Yomol, Nimchak Ben Shnei Yamim. Done. End of the Gemara. That's it. And the Balei Tosafot say, what about leaving it around? It won't do anything for you. You're just extending the same problem out into the future, which is there's always a difference between the number of days that it was erased. Therefore, you'll never be able to compare the two side by side to see whether it is the same or it is different. The other way to read it is what we have in our Gemara, which is, Eino Domen Nimchak Ben Yomol, Nimchak Ben Shnei Yomim, L'Shayei, that would solve your problem. And then Rabbi Yirmiyah's answer is, Chashin LeBeit Din Toin. Then the other possibility is that we don't have the answer of Rabbi Shai at all. And then the answer here is, Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, Chashin LeBeit Din Toin. That's why we worry about it here, and then you have a standard answer. So three different ways to read the Gemara, depending on the Girsa. The Beit Din Toin problem is also interesting because we could see in the Rabbeinu Gershom that the problem is Elkach Gazer the Pasul Afkav the Efsher Bebedika Mishum Beit Din Toin Lo Badke Elugavu the Altar. It's a halachic problem, which is they won't know the din and then it will just collect on it without making any check. On the other hand, the way that the Rashbam brings it, they won't be able to discern. They don't have the expertise to do it. I mean, they'll know the din, but they still won't know what to do, and they'll make a mistake, because it's all about the eye, or discerning between two different klafim. So yeah, in Ochanami, they'll do what they're supposed to do, but then they won't be able to tell the difference, or they'll think it's the same, because it takes an expertise that they won't have, and that's the Beit Din Toin over here. But the truth is that the Rashbam actually brings both of those views down, depending on what the Girsa was, which is that if you just have the Girsa of Rabbi Yirmiyah, then he says that we're worried about a Beit Din being lazy, not really dealing with the issue, similar to what the Rabbeinu Gershom says. On the other hand, in the first answer where he has both Girsot over there, he says Beit Din Toin is v'lo yedu l'daktei kolkach. They won't know or be able to be discerning in that manner. They'll want to do it, but they just won't have the expertise to do it. So you see both of those answers in the Rashbam, but depending on the Girsa. He thinks if the Girsa is like in our Gemara, then the Beit Din Toin over there is a Beit Din that won't have the expertise. And then if you just have the answer of Rabbi Yirmiyah, then he thinks the Beit Din Toin is like the Rabbeinu Gershom, which is that they will literally make a mistake in halacha or in knowing this matter, and they will be lazy about it and just let it go through without checking on it. The Beit Din Toin problem is also interesting because we said back in the Gemara, I think it was on Kuf Lamed Chet, that we don't worry. In Choshishin the Beit Din Toin, we don't worry about Batei Dinim making mistakes. So here you have to distinguish, and that's maybe how you can resolve the stira between here and that on Kuf Lamed Chet, where there we don't worry about Beit Din Toin. That's in matters of halacha. In matters of bedika or expertise, technical expertise, there we worry about Batei Dinim making a mistake. And there, as the Rishbam says, therefore we standardize the halacha that it's going to be a pasul or a problematic in all these instances. Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel Omer Mikushar. We said before in the Mishnah, Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel says if you sign on the inside of a Mikushar, then you basically have a get pasul, then it should be kosher. Heishiv Rabbi Ledivri Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel. The Rabbi responds to that statement of Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel. Hello, Eino Domed Zmano Shel Zeh, Lizmano Shel Zeh. Isn't there a difference in the way that they are dated? A get pashut and a get mikushar use a different dating system. And therefore, even if you sign on the inside, you're going to have a problem because you have a different dating protocol for these two items, which is pashut. When you're dealing with a get pashut, or a document that is a simple document, malach shana, if the king was in his first year of his reign, monim lo shana, then you write in the first year of king so-and-so. Shtayim, it's the second year of his reign, monim lo shtayim, then you write in the second year of that king's reign. Mikushar, on the other hand, when it's a get mikushar, malach shana, if he's in his first year of his reign, monim lo shtayim. Yeah, right, it's the second year of his reign, even though it's really the first. Shtayim, if it is the second year of his reign, monim lo gimel. They write that it's the third year of his reign. Now, why would you make such a distinction? The Rishbam over here says that that was the practice in these places. I mean, that the practice in these neighborhoods or in these regions was to add on a year to the king's reign. Sharei minhag ha'uma kedelkaman. Lagdib namelech shana. V'shema l'chvod ha'melech hayu osim. Maybe they did it in honor of the king. Klomar. He already has been king for 2 years. It's a compliment to the king that he's already ruling for a period of time. And the Chachamim instituted that they would write the dating system of the Mikushar following the practice of the local population. The purpose of that is to create additional differences or distinctions between a mikushar and a pashut. The whole reason is the takanat chachamim to slow down the process. The more you make it different, the harder it will be to write. The less experts you'll have that can write it. Plus they'll have to think and have to take their time to do it. You can't just spin out a get mikushar because you have to think about what the dating is. You have to do all these things that are specific or unusual about it. That'll slow down the process, and that's the whole point of the takanat of get mikushar, was to slow down the kohen from divorcing his wife with the document. Some even suggest over here that post-dating it, in essence, makes it that the kohen will think, I have more time to use the shtar. Since the shtar is really dated a year from now, he'll think, oh, I don't have to give the get now. I have another year where I can use the get. And in the meantime, his anger will be assuaged. So they just think of it maybe even as a ploy to help the Kohen to take his time is by post-dating it. The other possibility, which I think is that it's a bracha, which is saying that, oh, in the second year of this king's reign, even though he's in his first year, which is a bracha, that you should have a second year of reign. That would be the way that I would suggest maybe they did it or why they did such a thing. But nevertheless, that is the practice. So now you have a problem, which Rabbi says is, if you sign on the inside of a get mikushar, you're going to have a different date than you would have had if it was a get pashut. Okay, so you have a different dating mechanism. What's the big deal? Because the way that they're writing it here, it's going to turn out to be a shtar meuchar, which is a post-dated shtar. If you have a pre-dated shtar, then you worry about it because then you're giving rights to the creditor that he shouldn't have had, which is now he has rights to foreclose on the properties based on an earlier date. And that's problematic. But over here, you have a post-dated shtar. So what's the big deal? Because Zimnin, the Yosef Mnei Zuzei b'mikushar, he borrowed money from him in a document that was a mikushar. Umitramile Zuzei beni beni. And all of a sudden, he comes into some money, gets a windfall, wins the lottery, gets a Yerusha, and he wants to pay off the debt. So he hands him the money. Uparole. Amalei havli shtarai. Says, give me back my shtar because the borrowing documents of Amalei, irkasli, I lost it. It was ripped up. It got burnt up. I don't have the shtar. Bekotavlei tavra. And he writes for him a shover. He writes for him a receipt that says that he got the money back. Bechi matei zemnei. So mishavalei pashut. Then when, after it crosses over the date in the document, he turns it into a get pashut. Amalei, hani hashta yasve minai. You just borrowed that money from me. And the problem is that the receipt precedes the loan document. Because since the document was post-dated, so he borrowed money on a given date, but the date in the shtar mikushar was a year later. So now, it looks like a get pashut, because they signed on the inside with the dating of a get mikushar. So he has a post-dated borrowing credit document, and then he goes and pays it back within that year. Then the individual says, I don't have the shtar, and he says, okay, give me a receipt. So he gets a receipt. When he gets the receipt, and the creditor comes to Beit Din and says, look, I have a shtar that he owes me money, he looks at it and says, it's a get pashut, it's dated for like 5 days ago. So it looks like he just borrowed money. The guy shows up with the receipt and says, I paid it back. They say, you paid this back a year ago. This has nothing to do with this shtar. You paid it back before you borrowed this money. So now the creditor has a right to double dip against this debtor because of the way that you made it into a get pashut, the dating of a get mikushar. So now you have a problem. Kasavar in kotvim shover. He says that you don't write a receipt. Meaning that according to Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, you're not allowed to write a receipt for a document of Eshem Machloket coming up in the Gemara as to whether when you borrow money and then you repay it, when you repay it, can you accept a receipt for the repayment or do you have to get the original shtar back? If he doesn't hand you the shtar back, you don't have to pay the loan back. So that might be the way to prevent these types of problems. So there's a day out that the only way to have repayment done is that you hand the original document back so that way you can rip it up. If you don't hand the original document back, you're not getting your money back. So in that case, he's protected because then there'll never be this problem of taking out a receipt that is dated prior to the shtar itself. So what we have to say is Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel subscribes to that position that there is no such thing as a receipt that's given. There is another opinion, and obviously according to that opinion, you would have a problem in this instance. Now, the question that is being posed by Rabbi is not just a problem for get mikushar, where it is post-dated. It's a problem in any post-dated shtar. We had this before, that the member of the Chachamim, that predated shtarot, shtarot ha-muktamim are psulim. Shtarot ha-mukharim, post-dated shtarot are no problem at all, because they only hurt the creditor. They don't do anything that's negative in terms of any of the parties here. All of a sudden, you're discussing an issue where we start to worry about the debtor in this case, versus in the case of any other shtar meuchar, we don't worry about the debtor. We don't worry about the fact that this scenario could play out, that they shtar meuchar. Anything that's post-dated, why do we say that it's kasher? All we say is, oh, the lien of the creditor just comes in later, which is to his detriment. So there's no problem with the post-dated shtar. What do you mean there's no problem with the post-dated shtar? We just saw a huge issue with the post-dated shtar, which is that if a person borrows money and then repays it in the time before the post-dated shtar goes into effect, then he can come back and claim against them again. The Baal Tosfot say, the buyers now are going to be hurt by his claim. Aval mishum pseida delovan. The fact that the debtor will lose out, lo ichpatlan, we don't care about the debtor. Diu afsid anafshe, kishalava b'hai shtara, can appreciate the el gabi edim. Same thing that I explained before by edim that sign on a document, and say they sign with gapping or space in front of them. So if they sign in such a manner, and then someone comes along and writes something in front of it, that aid that signed that way, that's his problem. The fact that you sign in a way that allows someone to come and implicate you or obligate you is your problem. So again, if you sign one on top of the other, even if you sign in the middle of the shtar, you still have a risk. Not that the guy will come and write a shtar and have two edim signed to it, but rather you have a problem that the guy will come and write in front of your signature, I so-and-so borrowed money, and here's my signature. You have his handwriting right afterwards, which basically affirms the fact that in his own handwriting, he borrowed money. So the Baal Tosfot said before, we don't worry about that. That's the aide's problem. The aide wants to sign in a way that he's open to forgery, or open to a problem. That's the aide's problem. We're not out there to protect the aide. Similarly over here, he says, we're not out there to protect the loved, the debtor in these instances, because the debtor made a bad choice by allowing such a document to be the document that evidences their credit agreement. What we're worried about here are the lekuchot, the buyers of property who are now going to be claimed against or have their property foreclosed on, even though it wasn't true. The debt was already repaid. There was no lien here. And all of a sudden he shows up with a document and says, oh, I borrowed money. The loved loses? That we don't worry about. What we're worried about is now he can go after the loved's property that he sold in the interim, and those lekuchot are now going to get hurt by that. That's what we worried about it. Although then Tosfot backs away from that and says, maybe we're not so harsh. And this is a situation in which the kuchot won't lose because there's no recourse. There's no lien over here. And maybe a filochi chashin lepsei to the love. We do worry about the debtor. Shein zes hefsei she'alove yodei ali zaher kolkach. Because this is a scenario or a situation in which the debtor would not be so advised or wise to know that there'll be a problem. And he wouldn't be able to predict or know that he'd be get cheated in this case. So Lover is an innocent in this case, and therefore maybe we will protect him. So Tosfos does speak about, first of all, the issue of what are we worried about? Are we worried about the buyers who are now going to be foreclosed on improperly? Are we worried about the debtor who's going to be claimed against twice? Tosfos brings both possibilities. One possibility that the debtor we don't worry about because it's the debtor should have been wise to this and known not to borrow like this. Or the other scenario, he says that this type of scenario is so unusual or far-fetched that maybe even here we will look out for the debtor or the protection of the debtor. And that's why we won't allow such a document to be used. So leaning on that second answer of the Balei HaTosafot, the Ritva answers over here that it's different in a case of a shtar meuchar. Over there, people are familiar with the shtarot and they'll know that it was a post-dated shtar. And therefore, they'll know to get a receipt that matches with the post-dated shtar. But with regards to get mikushar, people were not so familiar with them. And therefore, it's easy for someone to make a mistake and not know that the shtar was post-dated and get stuck in a trap like this. And that's actually what precipitated Tosafot in the second answer say that we do protect the low veil here. Even though generally, don't worry about the debtor because he just made a bad decision. Over here, we do protect them because the nature of a get mikushar is something they're not familiar with. And since he doesn't have familiarity, we need to protect him because he won't be able to protect himself. All right, now, the Gemara says, Vau mi boki rabbi mi mikushar. All of a sudden here, Rabbi is saying, oh yeah, there's a difference between the dating system in a get pashut and a get mikushar. We saw earlier back on Daf Kuf Samech, and we're going to see again now, that Rabbi didn't know a lot of information about a get mikushar. Vau mikushar da'ata l'kame de Rabbi. This get mikushar came before Rabbi. Vamar Rabbi, shtar meuchar zeh. This is a post-dated shtar. Vamalei zonin l'Rabbi. So zonin says to Rabbi, kach minagash alumazo. That is the practice of the populace over here. Malach shana. If he ruled for 1 year, monim lo shtayim. They say he ruled for two. Shtayim, if he ruled for 2 years, monim lo shalosh. They count it as if he was there for 3 years. The Gemara says, boter de shama mizonin savro. Once he heard this from Zonin, he became an expert. He knew the information. Now that he knew the information, that's when he posed a question against Rabbi Hanina ben Gamliel's position, once he already had been informed that that was the difference between a get mikushar and a get pashut. As I noted before in Kuf Samech, the fact that Rabbi is asking these questions about the get mikushar shows you that it was not in heavy use, or they weren't in circulation, these gitim and mikusharim. And that leads to the question before, what exactly was the Takanat Chachamim, and that's what the Balei Tosafot dealt with back on Daf Kuf Samech, what was the nature of this Takanah. So now the Gemara moves on and says, Haushtara, Dabakotav Bei Mishnat Ploni Arkan. So there was this shtar that was written in it in such and such a year of Arkan. Amar Chanina Ivadek Ematay Amad Arkan Ba'arkunute. Let us go see when he came to power, or when he started his reign. V'delma d'arich malchute, who says that it was the first year of his reign. Maybe he's been in ruling for 30 years. How do you know when it says in the document, in the year of the king, or the so-and-so, the Arkan? How do you know what year of the king it's referencing to? Why does Rabbi Chanina automatically assume it's the first year of his rule? So it says, I'm Rabbi Shaya, kach minaga shalomazo. This is the practice of the locals. Shana Rishana Korim Lo Arkan. In the first year of his reign, he's called an Arkan. Shnia Korim Lo Digun. In the second year of his reign, he's called a Digun. The way the Rashbam learns this is that this has got to do with the regular kings. The kings that are appointed, they don't get the name of king until later on in their rule. In their first year of rule, they're called an Arkan. And you can see here that the Rashbam translates that as Mitukan Malchut Michadash. This person is ra'oi, proper, appropriate to be the king, and that's what the word arkan or aruch means. And I would think that the word arkan from the word aruch or arich means to extend. And maybe that was the idea that in the first year of the king's reign, they gave him a bracha that his reign should last a long time. And that's why he was called an arkan. Even though he was a very short reign, it was a bracha that he should have a long reign. In the second year of their rule, they're called a digun. We'll see these are Greek words, and the word digun means two. We'll see that in a second. But that was the way that they named them. And then in the third year, he was already called the king. Once his kingdom was around for a while, they called him a king. So if you have a document that has the word Arkan in it, you know for sure it's the first year of his reign, because that was the name assigned to individuals in their first year of their reign. The Baal Yad Tosafot take issue with that, and he says, V'nir the re, Dai Arkan Mav Hainu Melech. This Arkan is not a king. Ele Mimuneh. It is an appointee of the king, which they turned over every year. He used to appoint the individual, and that was the name of him, the Arkan. So the Arkans in general were only around for 1 or 2 years, because it was a position appointed by the king, and he changed it over every 1 or 2 years. And so the Arkan is not the king himself, but rather a position. But the fact that he's an Arkan already indicates that he was there only for a year. And if he was Digun, he was there for 2 years. But that was the way that they referenced them, so therefore you know the document was in the year that he came to power. Vidoma Avure Avrua, maybe they deposed him, Vader Ukmu, and then they reinstated him. So now the way the Rashbam reads it is that maybe they deposed the king, and then they reinstated the king. So how do you know when it says Arkan, which was it the first year of his first reign, or the first year of his second reign when they brought him back? Amar Yirmiyahu Arkan Digun Karile. If they bring him back or they reinstate him, he's not called an Arkan, he's called a Digun. Or in essence, do we count as if the first reign is then succeeded by the second reign? So that if he had 1 year in his first reign, then when he comes for the second reign, they won't call him an Arkan again, they'll call him a Digun as if he's in the second year of his reign. So they count or they cumulatively add the years from his first reign to his second reign, and therefore he won't be called an Arkan the second time he's reinstated. This question and answer is what pushes Tosafot to say that he thinks that the Rashbam's explanation is incorrect. He says kings don't usually get deposed and then reinstated. The king's deposed, he's gone, usually killed. But even if he wasn't killed, he's not usually reinstated. That's why he thinks that this position was an appointment of the king. And therefore you do have a possibility if it's a political appointment or a way to say thank you to your allies, then a person could be appointed once, and then in another cycle or another time, he could be appointed again. And so there's a possibility that the person would serve in this post multiple times, but not consecutively. So the Gemara answer is that for those individuals, according to the Baal Yad Tosafot, when it was their second time doing this, they would not consider it as if he's an Arkan. They would give him the title of Digun, which is this person who had already accumulated years and had more experience, and they would give him that title right away because he had already served once as an Arkan. Right, Tanir Rabbanan, already Nazir, if he says, I am a Nazir, and then after the Nazir, he puts in a qualification. Which he uses the following terms that Sumchus is going to introduce to us. Sumchus Amar Hina Achat, says, Areni Nazir Hina, I am a Nazir Hina, that means one Nazirut, which is a standard Nazirut of 30 days. Digun, Shtayim. He says, Areni Nazir Digun, it means two. Trigun, Gimel, means three. Tatrigun, Arba is four, Pantigon, Chamesh is five. So you can already see here, these are the Greek words for these items, words that we are familiar with. And what they're saying is that if you use the Greek language that has enumerations in this manner, over here it really means something with corners. It means three corners, four corners, five corners. Or in our case, it means, in the context that's being used, it means five times, four times. So he says, Areni Nazir, Pentagon, it means I'm a Nazir five times over, which is five times 30 days, and it would seem like he would have to do five different Naziriot, meaning that he's not saying a one Nazirut that is 150 days long, rather he's saying it is five Naziriot in succession that it will do, although you could possibly read it that he is just telling about one big Nazirut. But the words that are being used here is hina, which is the Greek for one, similar to the word one. Digun is from the word die, which is two. Trigun is from tri, like triangle, that's three. Tetragon is from tetra, which is four. And then you have pentagon, which is like what we have today, the pentagon is five. So now the question really is, what's the chiddush over here? Is there any chiddush in the fact that if you use the Greek words, that it works? So some suggest that that is the chiddush itself. That even though you use the Greek language, that it is binding, despite the fact that you didn't use the Hebrew language. On the other hand, the Baal Yad Tosafot suggests that hapshita, mali lashon ivri, mali lashon yivani, mali lashon laz. Why should it make a difference if you speak in Hebrew, Greek, or in German, French, whatever it is that you're speaking, why should that make a difference? If he doesn't really know what these words mean, and in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew, they have no meaning, these words. Nevertheless, it'll be binding. In essence, what the Tosafot says here, similar to what the Gemara says in Nidarim, with regards to certain languages that the Chachamim instituted at work. For instance, Hareni Naziach, Nazik. And we saw those words in Nidarim, in the Machloket, in the Gemara, as to whether those were words that the Chachamim made up, or those words in different languages. But what came of it is that if you use those words, even though you don't know what they mean, you are bound by what you said. So if you say, a person says Hareni Naziach or Nazik, even though the word should be Nazir, and he doesn't really know the language that he's speaking, nevertheless, the Chachamim instituted those words mean the equivalent of Hareni Nazir, and he will be a Nazir. And that's what the Tosafot is saying is the Gemara, or the Chiddush of the Bright to hear, is the fact that these words, even if you don't know what they mean, you'll be bound by them. So even though you don't speak Greek, if you say Hareni Nazir Trigun, you would have to keep three Naziriot, or the equivalent of three Naziriot, even though the word Trigun, or Tri, is the Greek word for three, you are going to be bound by it, even though you don't know what it means, or you don't know the Greek language. So that's what the Chiddush of the Bright is, according to the Balei Tosafot. Tan Rabbanan. So another extension from this, a sidebar, based on this idea of the language. Bayit Agul, if you have a house that is circular, Digun, a house that has two corners to it, Trigun, a house that has three corners to it, Pentagon, or five corners to it. So again, Pentagon, you can see a picture in the Rashbam already of a house that has five corners to it. A case of a triangle, easy to understand how you have a house as a triangle. House is a circle, so easy to understand. The question you're asking is how do you have a house with two corners? The answer is that one side has two corners and the other side is circular. You have a semicircle on one side and two corners, it's squared out on the other side. So in that way, you'll have two corners and the other side will be semicircular. In all of those situations, the Braita tells us, Einu mitameh b'nigayim. It's not subject to nigay batim. Tetrigon, if you have a four-cornered house, mitameh b'nigayim, then it's subject to the din of nigayim. That's your normal, standard house. Minahani mileh, where do you know this from? What is the source for this statement of the Braita that only four-cornered houses have a din of nigay batim and not these other types of houses? The Tan Rabbanan, l'malo omer, above it says kir kirot. In the Parshiot of Nigei Batim, it says kirot in plural. The Gemara says kir, you could have written kir, it wrote kirot, which is plural, that's two. Shtayim, that tells you about two. Lamato mer, kir kirot. Below, again in the pasuk below, it says that the kirot abayit. So it says kirot in plural again, so they go kir kirot means two. Shtayim, that's another two. Areikan arba, between the two times that the Torah uses the word kirot abayit, we will have a sum total of four corners or four walls that are being noted here. And therefore, the din of tumat nigei batim only applies to houses with four walls. So all of this was a sidebar because we spoke about the dating in the Get Mikushar. And then we spoke about a dating where it had the word arkan in it. And then we said that arkan is in the first year, digun is in the second year. And we got onto this Greek wording that tells us numbers. So then the Gemara went into a sidebar about the Nazir, and then parlayed that into Nigayim as well, where we have this enumerating based on the Greek numbers, which is the Hina, the Digun, the Trigun, the Tetragon, and the Pentagon. So now it's interesting, the Rashbam over here quotes the Rabbeinu Chananel, and he says, Perish Rabbeinu Chananel ki yotzi bo, Amur, he brings down that there is this drasha. Ein lo l'kodesh baruch hu ba'lamo l'yirat Hashem. Hashem that only has his world, yirat Hashem, shenamar. Hain Yirat Hashem says, what do you mean Hain Yirat Hashem? That's in Yov. Shekem L'shon Yivani Korim Nachat Hina. Since Hain Yirat Hashem, Hain is the equivalent of one in Greek. And so therefore, the only thing that Hashem has in this world is the one thing Yirat Hashem. He says, V'shema B'sifrehem K'tuva. He says, we don't have it in our Gemaras. Maybe in the Gemara of the Rabbeinu Chananel, he had that girsa. So he brings a drasha that we don't have here, playing on the same idea here that the word hina in Greek is one. And therefore when it says, hey, yirat Hashem, that means the one thing that Hashem has in this world or wants in this world is yirat Hashem. It's very interesting. Drasha, But because they read Doresh a Pasuk in Tanakh based on the Greek language, which is interesting in of itself. Again, the Rishbam says we don't have it in our Gemaras, but maybe the Rabbeinu Hananel had it in his Gemaras. Now here we quote the Gemara that we saw back on Kuf Samach that also indicated that Rabbi was not aware or familiar with the Get Mikushar. How Mikushar, that's the Kamei de Rabbi. There was this Get Mikushar that came before Rabbi. But my Rabbi, Ein Zman Bazeh. There is no dating in this Shtar. Amalei Rabbi Shimon Birabi, the Rabbi. So Rabbi Shimon, his son, says to his father, Shema ben Ksharab Muvla. Maybe it is buried in the folds. Playa v'chazya, they opened it up, flattened it out, and they saw that date was there. Hadar chazim be Rebbe bebishut. Rebbe looked askance at this document, or in essence was displeased with this get mikushar. Whether that is, the Rishbam over here brings down two possibilities. Either kasavur shu katavo, he thought that his son, Rebbe Shimon, wrote it. Ubirtanolo ayosim mikushar ela pashut, ufishu toim bo. And Rabbi didn't like these gitin mikusharim because it led to problems and mistakes. He was promoting the use of gitin pshutin, and he believed that the get mikushar was not a way to go about. And now his own son is writing this get mikushar. So it looks like he is upset at his son for writing or engaging in the writing of such a get. Inami ilifishay muvla ben ksharav yoter midai. Or maybe he wasn't necessarily opposed to gitin mikusharin, but rather he was opposed specifically to this one, which where the date was buried so deep in the fold that it was not easy to find or not easy to spot. So that question of what Rabbi was upset about, was he upset about Get Mikushar in general? Or was he upset about this particular Get Mikushar that had the writing buried so deeply into the fold? So Amalei, so his son, Rabbi Shimon, after seeing his father's disapproval, Lav Ana Katavte, I didn't write it. Rabbi Yehuda chayta katve. But rather, Rabbi Yehuda the tailor wrote it. Amalei, klach, m'lashon hara zeh. Rabbi says to him, what are you doing? Why are you speaking lashon hara? In essence, what he's saying to him is, why did you mention who wrote it? All you had to do was disclaim the fact that you had written it. Have you said I didn't write it? Then according to the first version of what we saw before, Rabbi was upset that there was a get mikushar being written by his son. If he just disclaimed the fact that he wrote it, that would have been enough, because he wouldn't be upset at him. He didn't have to finger the person who did write it. Or if you say that Rabbi was upset by this get mikushar in particular, that the quality of the writing or the fact that the date was in the folds, that was something that was negative about this particular documentation. And Rabbi Shimon felt that Rabbi was upset about it and upset at him, and he says, no, it wasn't me, it was him. So again there, why is he fingering the person that did it when all he had to do was free himself of blame by simply saying that he didn't do it? That's why Rabbi responds to him and says, klach from Lashon Hara Zeh, you should back away, get rid of this Lashon Hara, I don't want to hear about who did it, it's fine for you to tell me that you didn't do it. It's interesting, just to note, the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Yud Aleph will get there, where Rabbi is giving shir, and while he's giving shir, he starts to smell garlic on somebody's breath, and then he says, I smell garlic here, who has garlic breath over here? So it's interesting that Rabbi himself, also in giving shir, did something that was along the lines of Lashon Hara, where he wanted somebody to identify themselves as the one that is got the garlic breath in the shiur. And then to protect all the parties there, somebody who was not the implicated party walked out, and then everybody else follows them out because they were upset at the way that Rabbi was conducting the shir or trying to implicate someone. But you see that it's a fine line between implicating specific individuals and getting to the bottom of a problem. Over here you have an issue, which is Rabbi doesn't want either get mikusharim written or these poor quality get mikusharim written. If Rabbi Shimon simply disclaims it, then right, he knows his son didn't do it, but that doesn't mean we've got to the bottom of the situation and figure out who did it so that they can stop him. And similarly, Rabbi and his shiur was trying to figure out who was the one with the garlic breath that was making it hard to teach. So again, he's looking to finger or point out someone in particular, but again, if you don't point them out, if you don't get to the bottom of the crux of the problem, then the problem will persist. So you have that balance between the two, but it's just interesting to note that story of Rabbi in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Zimin avayotim kamei v'kaposik sidra b'sefer tevilim. Rabbi's son, Rabbi Shimon, used to be before him. Rabbi was reading or learning in Sefer Tehillim. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom learns over here is, Pasik means that he finished. He was finishing one of the five books of Sefer Tehillim. That's what it means, Pasik. Others say that Pasik means that, like, Psukim, he was reading it. He was learning the Sefer Tehillim. Amar Rabbi, Kama Miyushark Tabzeh. How beautiful is the writing or the sofer who wrote this Sefer Tehillim? According to the Rabbeinu Gershom, it's simply that he finished the Sefer Tehillim. He's complimenting the fine writing that's there. For others, the word pasik on the other hand says, pasik over here has to do with the breakdown of the ptuchot and the stumot. That this sofer was medaktek to make sure that all the ptuchot and stumot were done properly. So this is what he's saying, it's not just about the aesthetics of the writing, but also the halachic writing, that this person knew what they were doing when they wrote it down. Amalei lavana katabte. It seems Rabbi's complimenting the sofer, and in the context, it looked like he thought his son Rabbi Shimon was the sofer. So Rabbi Shimon says, lavana katavte, I did not write it. Yehuda chaita katve. But rather, Yehuda the tailor is the one who wrote it. Amalei klach l'shon hara zeh. So stop with this l'shon hara. It says, Bishlama hotom, in the first case, or the first scenario, Ika Lashon Hara. I understand why Rabbi was dismissing what Rabbi Shimon said and said, I don't want to hear Lashon Hara, because there was negative. Rabbi was upset about the shtar, and then when he implicates someone, he's speaking Lashon Hara. Elohacha, my Lashon Hara, Ika. Over here was a compliment from Rabbi. Why would you say that a compliment is problematic? It says, Nishom de Rav Dimi. Because of what Rav Dimi says. The Tani Rav Dimi, Achua de Rav Safra, Rav Dimi, the brother of Rav Safra says, Olam, Ayisaper Adam betovlato shel chaveiro. A person should not speak positively about an individual. Shemitoch tovlato, bali de ra'ato. Because when you start speaking in a good-natured manner about someone, it ends up going down a bad path that turns negative and ends up in Lashon Hara. This is what is otherwise known as avak lashon hara, which is that you're not speaking lashon hara, but you are saying things that will instigate or initiate conversations that will in all likelihood lead to lashon hara. Now, this is a hard statement of the Gemara. That means you can't compliment people, you can't say nice things about people, because then that will automatically be considered avak lashon hara. So here, the Rishonim and Achronim narrow the scope of the statement and say that it's not you can't compliment people. There are two ways that it can really be a avak lashon hara. One is if you do it in front of someone you know dislikes this individual. So if you go and compliment in front of someone who dislikes the individual, you know what their reaction is going to be. Their reaction is going to be to undermine what you said. So by the context, you have a sense that the good things that you're saying or the compliments that you're giving are going to result in lashon hara because the person you're speaking in front of is not fond of that individual. Or it might be a problem of excessive compliments, or speaking about excessively about someone who is so good or so amazing, because people, when they hear about, quote-unquote, these amazing, amazing people, want to make them human again. So then they take down or they are negative on that individual. Or it's a situation in which this individual is questionable in his actions, and you happen to pick on the good things, but you know that this person has other things that are negative. And so by bringing up the positives, it will lead to the negatives. Or the way that the Maharal says it is that this individual's attributes can be interpreted positively or negatively. And therefore you are giving a positive spin to something you know others view negatively. Or in another way to say that is that what you're saying can be interpreted by us, some people to be a compliment and others to be interpreted as a criticism. It's actually what the Rashbam brings as the example for avak lashon hara from the Gemara in Arachin, which is, person says that there's always a fire on in so-and-so's house. So that can be interpreted positively, which is that they're always being machnis orchim, or they're always engaged in preparing, or it can be viewed negatively, which is they spend all their time cooking and eating. So here you have a statement that is in and of itself neutral, but can be interpreted to the negative side. So by narrowing the scope and not saying that you can't compliment, it's a problem where the context of the compliments will lead to a possible lashon hara, Again, that can be done in front of someone who dislikes the individual, or maybe there's too much positivity or too much in the way of compliments that are being given here, which causes others to jump in and give some negative surrounding that individual. Amarav, Amram, Amarav. Shlosh Averot in Adam Nitzol Mehem B'chol Yom. There are three sins that no person escapes from on a given day. Obviously, no person doesn't mean there's nobody, but it's rare to find someone who will escape from these three daily sins. The Maharal says over here, these are items that people easily trip upon because they come easy. Just thoughts and speaking that engage the person in such a Averot doesn't require any action or deep engagement for them to be involved in these Averot, which are Yerhur Avera, thinking improper thoughts, Iyun Tfila, which we'll have to discuss in 1 second, Vilashonara, and speaking Lashonara. Mar says, Lashonara, Salgadatcha? Is it really true that people speak Lashonara every single day? There's no escaping from it. Ella Avak Lashonara. It's not literally Lashonara. Rather, Avak Lashonara. People can't escape from it because many times they say positive things. They say these compliments that precipitate or lead to negative comments in reaction. And that's something that, even though they themselves are not doing anything wrong and they don't think they're doing something wrong, nevertheless, it ends up in a circumstance or situation that leads to Lashonara. So now, let's look at these three items. They touch on the different religious aspects or religious worship of the individual. The Hirurei Avera is Ben Adam Le'atzmo. Iyun Tfila is Ben Adam Le'makom. And then Lashon Hara is Ben Adam Le'chaveiro. So it touches on all these different aspects. And so these are sins that permeate or fill the lifetime of individuals in each of these areas. And again, for the reasons that we spoke about why these are common types of Averot, because people don't think of them as Averot, and they're things that people easily trip upon. Three items that we mentioned over here. Iyun Tfila presents a problem, and that is because we say every morning that one of the things that Adam Ochel Perot El Mazeh, the Keren Kayemet Le Olam Haba, is Iyun Tfila. So that quote, that says that Iyun Tfila is a positive item, not a negative item. So the question is, how is Iyun Tfila positive? Where here the Gemara deems it to be negative. But there are a number of possible explanations as to what Iyun Tfila is over here. You can see in the Rabbeinu Gershom that he says, Iyun Tfila, Shimchashev Bidato, Ikavein Bitfilati. He thinks, before he goes to Davin, he thinks, I'm going to have super Kavana in Davining, Shiaseli Ritzono, so that God will respond favorably to my Tfilot. It's as if he's testing God. It's as if he's putting up a test and saying, I'm going to daven with kavana, and let's see if God really is going to answer me or respond to my tefillot. So that's what the Rabbeinu Gershom sees as the problem here, is that this is premeditated in nature. It's not iyun tefillah where he's simply having kavana in his tefillah. It's premeditated. He's saying that when I have kavana in my tefillah, I expect God to answer me. That expectation, in essence, is a testing of God, whether he will or not respond to your kavanat tefillah. The Rashbam, on the other hand, says, V'yesh mifarshim shelachar sheyitpalel dan bilibo. After he davens, he thinks in his heart, Shishalem lo kadosh baruch hu scharo, that God should pay him back for his great davening. V'yaseh kadosh baruch hu tzrachav, that Hashem should do whatever he asks for, v'yishma tefillato, and listen to a tefillah, shelefi sheyitpalel b'kavanah. Since he davened properly. So as the Rabbeinu Gershom sees it as being prior to his davening, and it's as if he's testing God, the Rashbam sees it post his davening, saying that I'm deserving of God's intervention, I'm deserving of God's response here, because I davened so well. So that's the way that the Rashbam learns it. If you look in the Balei Tosafot, the Talei Tosafot bring that reasoning, which the Tosafot quotes the Gemara in Brachot, who says again that a person is ma'ein b'tfilato, bali de kev leiv, and he explains it, hurrah! This is a negative statement about Iyun Tfila, because you may hire hair b'tfilato. He starts to think about whether his prayers are being answered or not being answered, and that's a negative aspect of it, and that's what the Rashbam seemingly is speaking about. But then he says, avel enu nira, that doesn't seem to be the right explanation over here, because harbei b'nei adam, ein mitzapim matai yavo tfilatam. So there's plenty of people who don't think, when is my tfila going to be answered? Shemi kavanim kol kach. She had the tefillah tam. They don't have such great kavanah in their tefillah where they can really say afterwards to God, where's my response? How come he didn't answer in the affirmative? So he says that there's so many people out there that just don't daven with kavana and don't have expectations that God is going to answer them. And here you just said this is a sin that people do every single day. Well, there are plenty of people who don't get involved in this sin. So that can't be the explanation. El Avanira, the rabbi over here is probably the reed that is speaking about. The Ion Tfilah, Shura, She'en Mikavanim Tfilatan. We say Ion Tfilah is something negative. That's when they don't have kavana in their davening. A lack of kavana means, Ion Tfilah means that you lack the depth of Tfilah, plumbing the depths of Tfilah, which means having kavana for Tfilah. The lack of that kavana is problematic. And this is where the Bali Tosafot speak to a problem that we all have. She'en shum adam yachol lekaven tfilato heitev. Nobody can daven with proper kavana all the time. And even on a given day, it's very hard to daven with kavana. It's a challenge for every human being to daven with kavana. And given that, it's very likely that a person who's davening, even on a regular basis, will not reach that kavana. Tosafot in Rosh Hashanah, Andaftet Zayin Amud Bet, actually quotes this same answer in the name of the Rabbeinu Tam, where he says, Iyun Tfilah Omei Rabbeinu Tam, Iyun Tfilah Adahacha, Yayid Get Pashut. The Iyun Tfilah here in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah is similar to the Iyun Tfilah it's mentioned in Get Pashut, our Gemara over here. The Gimel Dvarim Ein Adam Nitzol Mehem B'chol Yom, B'kach Hashiv Iyun Tfilah, Klomar, She'ein Mikaven Libo B'Tfilato. That he doesn't daven with proper kavanah. Mitoch Shadam Mitpalel, Veinu Mitkaven, and since a person, when they daven, doesn't have kavanah, Averutav Nizkarim, then his Averot are brought to the forefront. He says, Miu Lo Yitaken Nefaresh Kein Klau. Says, that doesn't make sense. Ella, Adarabba, Mayri Bimit Ametz, Likaven Libo. It's a case where he's trying to have kavanah, Buteach She Tfilato Nishma'at. And he really thinks that his tefillah is going to be heard. So over there, the Bali Tosfot bring from the Rabbeinu Tam this idea of Kavanat Tzfilah, where the Bali Tosfot reject it and say, no, that's not the reasoning, but rather similar to the reasoning that's brought by the Rashbam over here, which is this, a person who davens in such a manner where he believes that his tefillah will be heard, or that he believes that God owes him his tefillah, and that's why his Averot are getting mentioned, is because he has such confidence in his tefillah that God should have to answer him for his Kavanah, then they're going to put him on trial, basically. If you want God to answer your tefillah, and you think you're deserving that God should answer your tefillah no matter what, then we're going to put you on trial and see, are you deserving of what you're asking for? And that's why Mazkirin Lo Avonotav. That's why you're going to bring up the Averot. So the Tosfot in Rosh Hashanah rejects the reasoning, the primary reason they bring over here, which is lack of kavanah and tefillah. And they take up the reasoning that's brought by the Rashbam and rejected by the Bali Tosafot over here. Though you could differentiate between the Gemaras, because the Gemara over here speaks about an Avera v'Iyun Tfilah that happens every day, whereas in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, it speaks about Iyun Tfilah, which is Maskirin Abunotav Shel Adam. And that might be what the Bali Tosafot are disagreeing with the Rabbeinu Tam over there, is in equating the two cases. Here, where it's speaking about an Avera b'chol yom, that might be speaking about Kavanat HaTfilah. Whereas over there in Rosh Hashanah, where it's Maskirin Avonotav Shel Adam, that might be referencing to Iyun Tfilah, like the Rashbam explains over here, which is expectations or confidence in the answering of your Tfilah, which can bring up Avonot. Although from the Peushim of the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Gershom, it seems that they are leaning on that Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, which says that it's Maskirim Avonotav Shel Adam, and that's why they are giving their interpretation here, which is something that precipitates looking into the individual's file. Now, from this, it would seem that maybe it's better not to daven than to daven without Kavanah. In some of the printings of the Nefesh HaChaim, they have in the back their essays. And there in the Ruach HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner writes about this issue about not having Kavanah and Tefillah. And he says that one has to daven every day, even though they don't feel it. One has to daven every day, even though they don't have Kavanah. Because the only chance that you will get to a Tefillah that has Kavanah is if you are engaged in Tefillah. If a person says, I won't daven unless I can have Kavanah, or I won't daven unless I really have the feeling, a strong feeling towards Tefillah, a person will never come around to daven. They will always feel there's some deficit. They will always feel that they can't do it. Or be rare, far between when they actually daven. So he says it's better for them to daven every day. And then by being engaged in tefillah every day, you actually every day or have a chance or an opportunity to daven bikavanah. And in that way, there's a higher likelihood that you end up with a tefillah bikavanah Because you're davening every day, and then the possibility of kavanah exists. If you don't daven, the possibility of tefillah with kavanah is almost impossible, because people won't reach it or feel it of their own, and so you need to be engaged in order for it to happen. And that's how the Ruach HaChaim deals with that, and says, yes, it's better not to daven without kavanah. But if you don't daven, then you're never going to daven with kavanah, and therefore we have to daven without kavanah in order to facilitate the ability to daven with kavanah. Now Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Rov begezel umiyut ba'arayot, v'kol b'lashon hara. When it comes to mankind, or to human beings, majority of them engage in gezel, in theft. The way that the Rashbam words it over here is, Rov b'nei adam choshrim ha'gezel ke'en gezel shemarim le'teira. We're not talking about thievery in the sense of going in and stealing something from someone. Rather, b'masal matan, in business, to withhold profits from somebody. You're not stealing in the sense of you're taking away the principal or the property of an individual. You are doing it by withholding profits from another party. So say you're partners and you're supposed to split the profits. A person will justify to themselves that I worked harder here, I can keep more of the profits, and I'll keep more of it for myself and not give it to the other person. So when it's taking away revach or profits to another party, people are more heter. They give reasons or try to talk themselves into why it is mutar, why they should be able to do this. And then they go ahead and steal, not in the active sense of stealing, but it's stealing in the passive sense, which is that they don't give what the other person deserves. They withhold giving them those profits. And Rabbeinu Gershom says something simpler, which is, shemichazvin b'masa matan u'mishakrim. People cheat, steal, not in the active form, but in business, in transactions, in dealings, by which they will profit more, or they'll withhold profits from others. It's something that is very common. So for that reason, gezel is something that plagues most people, because everyone's out for their own best interests, and therefore they're always looking out to preserve or take the whatever capital is out there for themselves, and they do that at the expense of others. Miut barayot, arayot, which is a significant problem, but it's still not as prevalent as things like gezel, especially after, as the Gemara tells us in the Gemara in Yoma and the Gemara in Sanhedrin tell us, that the Chachamim blinded the Yetzer Hara for arayot, so they reduced that drive or reduced that problem in terms of averot. V'kol b'lashon hara. And everybody is in violation of lashon hara. Again, b'lashon hara sagadatcha. I mean, you can't get through a day without speaking Lashon Hara. Even by accident, sometimes you get through a day without speaking Lashon Hara. Ella, avak Lashon Hara. The problem here is not Lashon Hara, but rather avak Lashon Hara, and that's hard to escape from, because just in your normal course, you speak to people or speak about people, and even when you're complimenting or saying something nice, avak Lashon Hara brings in the possibility that it will lead to Lashon Hara. And that's why people can't escape from it, or it happens all the time, is because avak Lashon Hara is almost a natural way for people to be, which is positive about others. But that positivity ends up leading to negativity, and that's why the avak lashon hara is problematic, and it's something that people don't necessarily think of as an avera. And that might be the common denominator over here between rov gezel and a kol b'lashon hara, as well as the items that we mentioned before, which were hirhura reva, iyun tefillah and lashon hara, which we said was avak lashon hara. These are all averot that people justify to themselves or don't think of them as averot, because they don't involve necessarily action or activity, as well as the fact that in each of these cases, it seems that maybe even you're doing a good thing. You're davening. That's a good thing. But now you end up davening without kavanah. You are complimenting someone. It's a good thing. But the compliment is then leads to something negative, which is lashon hara. And hirurei avera, oh, it's only a thought. It's not something that I actually did. I didn't carry out the avera. And so therefore, hirurei avera, people discount or don't think as being problematic. And the Marsha notes that these three are the three areas of a person's life where they can sin, which I'm adding equate to b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol me'odecha, which is that here you have averot that are averot b'me'odecha b'mamon, and then you have averot b'guf, which are arayot, or ubechol nafshecha. You have averot that are benefesh, which is lashon hara, or ubechol levavcha. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Samech Hei, Amud Aleph.